A simple outline of what I want to cover tonight is in the program section on page 8. Last year, I attained 60 years of age. It's a pleasing achievement. It brings benefits. People make space for me to sit down. They smile more, as if to reassure me a little. And they speak a little louder, just in case. But it goes further than that. Last month, one of our close navigator colleagues in our international team described the four of us, Jim and Jerry and Paul and I, as symbols and myths. I think I like being symbolic. It feels dignified, it's almost contributory, but it is hard to know how to be a myth. And I've been thinking of this in the last few days when faced with this topic of our American culture and context. What to say? There are so many opinions, so many diagnoses, so many myths about our American condition. Everybody has a point of view, and every view is a view from a point. My opinions are in no way privileged, and yet our Lord told his disciples to interpret the signs of the times. Jeannie and I have lived for some 21 years in this safe and scenic part of America. It's a great country, and it has made us very welcome. So what should I say about this, my adopted country, related to our themes of fruitfulness and fragmentation? Let me begin with some readings that are taken from reputable surveys in the last few months, and then move towards a deeper level of analysis. We'll move from data to information to truth. First, some good news. In 1997, Americans were happier with their own lives and felt more religious conviction than at any time in recent years. Several surveys bear this out consistently. Fully 47% of our population say that they are highly contented with their lives. That's 9 points higher than at any time in the past 30 years. Consumer confidence reached a 28-year high. Of those who read the Bible more than once a week, 85% stated that they were extremely satisfied with their spiritual lives. Violent crime is less, the divorce rate is lower, the federal deficit is sinking fast, charitable giving is up 9%, poverty among African Americans and infant mortality are at record lows. Even the death rate from AIDS fell by 26% last year. Unemployment is at its lowest level for almost 30 years. The abortion rate, and this is a surprise, the abortion rate has dropped for 5 years in a row in this country. And whether we like it or not, our president's approval rating seems undentable. A survey of 250,000 freshmen at nearly 500 U.S. universities shows that students nowadays are more conservative on social issues than in past years. For example, the number of students who support legalized abortion has declined, and the number of students supporting casual sex has reached a new low, the lowest endorsing that in the last 10 years. Even those odious cartoon characters, Beavis and Butthead, on MTV have been canceled. MTV President Judy McGrath explained, quote, "Attitude is over. Today's youth are not into negativity," unquote. Interesting. Now, are these indicators and many others, are these signs of a deep change in the American psyche? Or are we merely having a temporary high stimulated by a healthy economy? The French Christian philosopher Jacques Ellul wrote about the sacred attention that we Westerners give to money and how it becomes the major power in our pantheon of deities. It is, he said, the measure in our society which eclipses all others. So if money is our God, then we certainly have cause to be cheerful this year. Our economy is surging ahead. Spending with credit cards was $36 billion in December, 16% up on the previous year. Good times. How about some bad news? In spite of all these good indicators, there seems to be little lasting rationale for our happy, contented sentiments. Here are some newspaper headlines from the last 3 months. Newborn girl found abandoned in a toilet at Walt Disney World. 11-year-old faces trial in Michigan shooting. Another newborn abandoned. Drugs and broken homes in every suburb of America. More suburban teenagers are inhaling heroin. A jury convicts 18-year-olds in the massacre of 16 cats. Hate crimes are up at our colleges. Assisted suicide law in Oregon. Skinhead violence in Denver. A judge admits that he lied about his past. A burglary suspect kills a police officer and then commits suicide. A depressing picture. And the misuse of money continues apace. For example, Americans are wagering nearly $600 billion a year on gambling, bingo, lotteries, and horse racing. More money than they spend on groceries. 50% more money than even 3 years ago. More than 50% of adult Americans are overweight. Roughly half of a family's food budget now is spent on eating out. The number of Americans who die annually from obesity-related diseases is 300,000. Almost as many as the 400,000 who die from tobacco-related diseases. Exercise is becoming a rarity. This surprised me. One American in four admits to being completely sedentary, and another 40% rarely exercise. More significantly, America's richest and poorest are still coming apart, growing further apart. Compared to the late 1970s, the income of the richest segment in this country has grown by 30%, and that of the poorest has fallen by 21%. There is an erosion of the middle class. 32% of 6- and 7-year-olds have televisions in their own bedrooms. And of course, as we know, they'll spend far more hours watching TV than attending school as they go through to graduation. Bad things. What about our dreams? What do we desire? What do we look forward to? What would we really like to have? Let's look at what we wish for, what we most desire. A recent survey of 1,500 Americans. The top five wishes of adult men, like me. A lower golf score, a Porsche, lose some weight, I can identify with that, the championship won by my favorite team, and some plastic surgery. It's not all fun being 60. The top five wishes of adult women, a little more adult, I believe, more time with their spouse, money, children's well-being, chocolate, and plastic surgery. Men come across as trivial and vain. Women come across as more family-oriented. Both of us are concerned with appearances. And what captivates our interest? These are the top 10 news stories in American media for the year 1997. I think we could have predicted the death of Princess Diana, but notice these other things. The dispute with Iraq, the hamburger meat recall in the fall, the McVeigh trial, UPS strike, floods in the Pacific Northwest, the mass suicide, O.J. Simpson's civil trial, the British au pair trial, and the birth of septuplets in Iowa. Notice how strongly crimes and disasters are featured in this list. There is, I suggest, a vicarious fascination with violence. Two examples. The vicious content of almost all video games which our children and our grandchildren watch. And secondly, the surging interest in this country in what is called extreme or ultimate fighting, a barbaric and very popular event, with the fans rooting for still more brutality. It reminds one of the Roman Colosseum. These are merely a few examples of what is good and what is bad in this culture at this time. They're very eclectic, some positive, some negative, some peculiar, from the recent soup of statistics that surround us. What's going on then underneath the surface, underneath the statistics? I think we can agree with three things that are truisms. Firstly, that change is accelerating. It means we're less able to digest or master anything. We can agree, secondly, that diversity is increasing. That's causing us to lose our critical faculties, our ability to discriminate. And thirdly, we can agree that complexity is overpowering us. It's forcing us to specialize and to ignore the larger moral issues. Acceleration of change, increase of diversity, the overpowering nature of complexity. This much is clear. The times are rushing by. But what is the root of the matter? How is the soul of America? Here I believe that the outlook is somber. I see three principal concerns. First, the melting, the evaporation of a moral vision. This was a city set on a hill for all to see, but we are no longer a beacon for the world. We are a discordant cacophony of grubby interests, as selfish as the next country, as expedient as the other party. Will and Ariel Durant have written that, quote, there is no significant example in history of a society that successfully maintains a moral life without the aid of religion, unquote. And I suggest to you that something unprecedented in human history is brewing, and that is a complete rejection of external moral sources. Listen to President Vaclav Havel, a survivor of a civilization that tried to live without God. Quote, I believe that with the loss of God, man has lost a kind of universal and absolute system of coordinates to which he could always relate everything, including himself. His world and his personality have begun to break up into separate, incoherent fragments. Unquote. What makes a person good? What makes you good, me good? What is good, anyway? Philip Yancey observes that many people can no longer answer that question with any assurance. And the sad thing is that this includes committed Christians. Listen to a young American believer called Susan. She's talking about the relationship between God and herself. And she says, quote, the Father and I are into relationships, not morality. Relationships mean being wholly supportive and standing alongside me, not judging me, unquote. She's got a buddy for a God, and he's being very nice to her, apparently. In such a climate, the melting of a moral vision, feelings replace argument, and we begin to swallow our own propaganda. It leads to fragmentation. Secondly, there is a loss of respect for truth. Truth is now pliable, moldable. It's a strategy more than a responsibility. Listen to another recent account by Philip Yancey. Quote, a representative of Generation X named Sam told me that he'd been discovering the strategic advantages of truth. As an experiment, he had decided to stop lying. He said, quote, "It helps people to picture you and relate to you more reliably. In fact, truth can be positively beneficial in many ways," unquote. So Sam is on the road to discovering something useful. For him, the decision to lie or to tell the truth involves not morality, but a social construction that he adopts or rejects as a matter of expedience. Is it good for him or not? The source of moral authority for all the Sams is themselves. And in many circles in this country, as you sadly know, the very idea, the concept of truth, is now derided. We have tenured professors at our major universities engaged in teaching us that everything varies according to my personal preferences. There are people, even in our Navigator movement, who squirm under the authority of the truth of the Word of God. If we go soft on truth, the Navigators will be gone in less than a generation. And much more importantly, God's meaning and purpose in redemptive history will be only a rumor. A loss of respect for truth leads to fragmentation. Thirdly and lastly, the picture is somber because we have, many of us, an instrumental view of human beings. What do I mean by that? Increasingly, we view other people as means, not ends. People are useful, aren't they? They're useful as consumers or spectators or voters or workers. They are pawns in the great game of achieving power. Relationships are functional. What can she or he do for me? In a culture where winning is everything, people are merely resources. And here, human dignity is at stake. Yesterday morning on National Public Radio, there was an interview with a certain Dr. Seed. He wishes to clone a human being. Indeed, he describes this as a moral imperative. His argument, if such it is, runs as follows. Quote, "God made man in his own image. We are intended to become one with God. We are going to become one with God. We are going to have nearly the power and nearly the knowledge of God. Cloning is merely the first step in becoming one with God." Unquote. Such a flawed view of humanity, not to mention flawed logic, surely leads to the triumph of what has been called the imperial self, a disaster that leads us far away from the biblical understanding of man. Ultimately, we become merely individuals adrift with our own opinions. Fragmentation. Any one of these three evil trends would be damaging. Together, they form a challenge which the cultural Christianity, which pervades America, is hardly likely to resist. We are hooked, aren't we, on religion light. Meanwhile, as Robert Bjork has persuasively argued, we are slouching towards Gomorrah. You and I are a remnant, not a moral majority. In our neighborhoods, we are engaged, or we should be engaged, in cross-cultural missions, fiercely so, not reclining comfortably in the ancient lap of Christendom. What is to be our strategy? Jesus Christ himself, the Jesus who said, "I am the way, the truth, and the life." Nothing else will suffice. Jesus is the way. Without his guidance, without his example, there is no way to rebuild a moral consensus or to defend our value system coherently. Without him, there is no standard or point of reference, no focus for reality. Jesus is the truth. Without him, there is no integration. And lastly, Jesus is the life. Without his incarnation, why should we respect humanity? Why should we agree that people are ends designed by God in his image for his glory? The call, therefore, surely the call for you and for me is not to be social critics. This is too light a thing. Diagnosis is easy, but we are called to be overcomers. I am the way, the truth, the life. Yes, this world is increasingly fragmented, but we are here by God's design in America at this time, by his appointment, to bear witness to the crucified Lamb who offers himself to us and to our neighbors as the way, the truth, and the life. Obedience to him alone is our salvation, and it is the eternal hope that we carry for the lost and damaged people of our time. Thank you.